Good afternoon, everybody. So I'm going to be talking about the extent to which amount of input influences the acquisition of language in young simultaneously and sequential bilingual children. And one reason for that is that it's interesting to look at how much input influences acquisition. But another purpose that I have in mind is a much more practical one, and has to do with the assessment of bilingual children. So I am a speech pathologist, and what we have to do often is to we get children referred to us who are bilingual and who are struggling. A lot of bilingual children actually struggle quite a bit. And we have to decide whether they have a language impairment. So I'm not going to lie to you. We're not very good at doing this. So we have very high rates of misdiagnosis going both ways. And so it turns out that a lot of the research that has been done on bilingualism doesn't really help us that much with that particular question. And so we have recommendations of best practice from the associations of speech pathologists, the big ones. And what they say is that you have to always assess both languages, because if you only assess one of them, you're seeing only part of what the child knows. And then you must not use monolingual norms. So you cannot assess one language and report to monolingual norms, because that is the reason why we over-diagnosed kids for such a long time. So these are good recommendations, and I agree with them. The problem with them, though, is that most of the times it's not possible. In the French schools here in Montreal, for example, we have kids of home language backgrounds include some 150 different languages. And it goes without saying, we don't have speech pathologists who speak those languages, and we don't know them ourselves. In most of these languages, there are no normative data, no tests, et cetera, so we can't do this. But then even in the cases where we can, let's say we have kids who speak French and English and we can test both of them, we don't know what to do with the results. How do we take the two results and somehow combine them for a result? We don't really know. And so the most common way of diagnosing language impairment in children is to use normative data. So we give them a test of some part of language, vocabulary, syntactic knowledge, or whatever part of language. Very often those two, actually, morphosyntax. And then we compare them to normative data. And we have a lot of research, quite a bit of research on English and on French, that shows that the cutoff that gives the most precise decision is around minus one standard deviation, or a little bit beyond that, minus one and one and a quarter. The problem with bilingual children is that we expect that they will score a little bit lower than monolingual kids because of their bilingualism, because we're testing only one of the languages. But the problem is we don't know by how much. And that is why we try to make allowances, but we're not really sure what to do, hence all the incorrect diagnoses that we come up with. So what I'm really trying to do is to try to quantify the effect of amount of input. We've known for a long time that input matters. A number of studies have shown that. Some people have, Barbara Pearson, for example, has suggested that it's a threshold effect, that if you get at least 20% of your time in a language, then you will become bilingual. If you get less, you don't. But we don't really know, and we haven't really known whether amount of input influences different domains of language in the same way or not. So this is what I've been trying to do. And so here in Montreal, we're in a good position to study this because we have children who speak two majority languages, French and English. So that allows us to control for a number of confounding variables that are often hard to control in bilingual populations, such as socioeconomic status and the status of the language as majority or minority language. So what I can do is I have these four eight age groups. I have three-year-olds, five-year-olds, and now extending this into school-age kids in grade one and grade three. So within each age group, the kids are pretty much the same age, the equivalent SES, et cetera, but they vary in how many of their waking hours they have been exposed to French or English over their lifetime. So we have a detailed questionnaire that we give to parents, and from that we compute the percentage of waking hours over the lifetime that was spent in French or in English. So I show you here the results for receptive vocabulary. So on top you have the English exposure, and on the bottom the French So that's on the bottom, we're testing them in French. And so I'm going to show you a number of graphs. It always goes from left to right, increasing percentage of English. And that, you see in the top graph that as kids are more exposed to English, they score higher in English. And the bottom graph shows that the more they're exposed to English, the less well they score in French, or you can read the graph backwards. So these are the 5-year-old children, and we see that amount of exposure has a pretty strong influence on their scores. We get the same result pretty much for 3-year-olds. I'm not going to show you those, but they're pretty much the same. So we can look at this, and we can try to see how much exposure it takes for kids to score within the normal range relative to monolinguals. So then I'm talking about the monolinguals that we tested. And we see by looking at these graphs that that happens at around 50%. And that is the same for 3-year-olds or for 5-year-olds. We find that if they have spent about half their time in a language, then they score non-significantly different from monolinguals in actually both languages. So if you have 50-50 kids score within normal limits in both languages, if they have had more than 50%, then they score within normal limits in that language. So basically children in Montreal, which is a bit of an ideal bilingual setting, they're going to score within normal limits in at least one of their languages. And so if we chop this up into groups, we find that it's only these groups of, it's only children who've had less than 40% exposure to a language, they will score significantly differently from monolinguals. If we look now at morphosyntactic development, we did spontaneous language samples where we looked at the length of utterance, which is a measure we often use clinically and also a lot in research. So you see that the effect on length of utterance is very similar to that of vocabulary. There's a significant relationship. And we find, in fact, the same effect that children who have about 50% exposure or more score within the normal monolingual range, and those who have lower exposure than that do not. Now, we looked also at diversity of use of morphology and accuracy of use. And what I'm showing you here is accuracy of use. So the morphemes that we code are not the same in the both languages because the languages have different grammatical structures. But what you see here is that, now I'm showing you from the English samples of the 5-year-olds at age 3 and at age 5. And what you see at a glance is that the 3-year-olds make a lot more errors than the 5-year-olds. So in English, there is quite a bit of morphological development taking place in that range. And the errors that kids make have to do with finiteness marking. So they're dropping their copulas, the third person S, just like monolingual English kids do when they're at low levels of language development. The French children, as you can see, the bars are all much higher. So yeah, the colors that we have represented there, the lightest colors, so the yellow in here, are the kids with the least exposure to French. So what we see is that French-speaking, when these bilingual kids are speaking French, they are a lot more accurate in their morphosyntax than when they speak English. So if I put all the graphs together for you, you see that sort of at a glance. So overall, there's much higher morphological accuracy in French than in English in the same bilingual kids. And the kinds of errors that they make are different between the two languages. So in English, the errors involve verb tense, and person marking. And in French, that is pretty much correct, starting at age 3 and at 5 years old also. So the kind of errors that we see have to do with gender, which English doesn't have. So what we see here, I just want to show you the example of one child here, just to show you what typically happens with kids who've had more exposure to French. So this child here has a higher MLU in French than English. She's 4.5 years old. In her French sample, she uses the correct present tense with a person marking. She uses two different past tenses and two different future tenses. In her English, she uses once the irregular past, never uses the regular past, and does errors like you see at the bottom. Well, she is at the optional infinitive stage. So even though in her French she's inflecting verbs, no problem, in English she's at an overall lower language level, and she makes errors that go with that. With that language level. So basically, in her English, she looks like a child that if she were monolingual, we would say she has language impairment because she still has optional infinitive errors. So the development of morphosyntax follows a very highly language-specific pattern, which indicates a very strong separation between the two languages, which is in line with a number of previous studies that have used, notably the MacArthur parent report. Okay. All I want to say about this is that we also looked at code switching. My student Nicole Wild, she looked at the extent to which kids code switch in these samples, because they were collected in a monolingual setting, so the examiner was monolingual. The amount of code switching is very low, but it was related to proficiency. So kids were more likely to code switch when they were speaking their weaker language. And within kids who did code switch, there was more code switching, or it was negatively related to performance. So it indicated that kids switched because they didn't have quite the language level needed to speak the way they wanted. Okay, so another thing we looked at was measures of language processing. So now when we test children, monolingual kids, to test for language impairment, we often use tests of sentence imitation or non-word repetition. So the idea here is that children with SLI have a big problem with non-word repetition that's been shown across a number of languages. For bilingual children, that's an attractive measure to use because non-word repetition and sentence imitation, they're tests that try to tap into a language processing ability rather than accumulated language knowledge. Now, the problem with testing bilingual kids is that their accumulated language knowledge is distributed over two languages. That's what makes it so hard for us to know what to expect. But if we can find a test of processing that is sensitive to language impairment but is not sensitive to differences in amount of exposure, then we would have a good test that would of language impairment regardless of bilingualism. So we looked at sentence imitation and the impact of amount of exposure, and the impact is actually similar to that of vocabulary. So in sentence repetition, there is actual true, there's real language, and so it seems that it does rely on accumulated language knowledge. For non-word repetition, the story is different. So here we really see a very small effect of amount of exposure, and we see that the kids, regardless of how much exposure they've had to French or English, they score uniformly pretty high. And so what we did in a sample of we compared children who have a language impairment. So actually, to date, there are very few published studies of bilingual children who have language impairment. This is one of them, and the study is unusual in that it has all four groups. So it has monolingual children with and without language impairment and bilingual children with and without language impairment. So the green bars are the monolinguals, the blue are the bilinguals. And so what we see here is that a measure of receptive vocabulary, which is accumulated language knowledge, cannot accurately separate children, the language impaired children, from the normally developing children. So that's because the bilingual children, the typically developing bilingual kids, score very low on the vocabulary. And compare that to the non-word repetition, where the non-word repetition measure actually correctly separates children with language impairment from normally developing children. Another thing that we found is that when we looked at the performance across different word lengths, we find that the normally developing children, monolingual or bilingual, are pretty much unaffected by the length of the non-words, whereas the children with language impairment, both monolingual and bilingual, do worse at the longer lengths. So the added processing load that comes with lengthening the words affects children with language impairment, but not bilingual children. And I have to say that there is controversy on this. These findings here are not in agreement with what some people have found. There are some studies on Spanish, English, bilingual children that also show similar results, and other studies that show that the effect on non-word repetition is greater than that. So we need more studies. However, I have found in studies that I've been doing in Iceland on large groups of L2 speakers of Icelandic, that even though they tend to score very low on standardized tests of Icelandic, they have no problems with repeating Icelandic non-words. So we found that in this study here on 40 bilingual children, and we've replicated that in a much larger sample of some 150 children. And in that study, we had children from tonal language backgrounds and non-tonal language backgrounds. And both of those groups did very well on non-word repetition. So another thing that I wanted to look at in these studies is the effect of the timing of bilingual input. So in the preschool children, the three-year-olds and the five-year-olds, they were all simultaneous bilinguals, meaning that they had all been exposed to bilingualism before age three. So we had nothing much to play with in terms of early and late onset. But we were able to find subgroups of children who were exposed before age 6 months and after 21 months. So after we had equated them on overall amount of exposure, then it turned out that it didn't matter at all whether they were exposed before 6 or after 21 months. So that was basically all we could do with that sample. But we've now been extending this study to school-age children. And so we're looking at first graders and third graders, and that's data collection that is still in progress, so I can only show you the vocabulary data. So we have kids in grade 1 and grade 3, and they include both simultaneous learners of English and French who are now going to French school. And then we have kids who are sequential French learners. And what you can see in this is that, so one of the questions that I have is, we've seen with the preschool kids that if you have only about a 35% amount of exposure, then you do not score within the normal monolingual range. But the question is, what if you continue to have that kind of exposure for another 2, 3, or 4 years? Then, does that help you to move into the normal range, or do you have to, at some point in time, have a more intense immersion? Do you have to do a 50% at some point in time? So that's kind of the question that I have. So these results are preliminary, but it kind of surprises me to see that both at age 1 and at the grade 1 and grade 3, the two bilingual groups still score pretty significantly lower than the monolingual children. And that is a bit worrisome because these kids have to do all their schooling in French. And to see that still in grade 3, they're still doing significantly worse than French, because French is the only language of instruction in those schools, that is a bit worrisome. Also, you can see that these kids vary in their exposure. So they haven't had as much exposure overall as the Francophone children. And now, in to try to look at age of onset in more detail, it's difficult to look. What I've talked about so far, I've always expressed the amount of exposure as the percentage of time. And of course, 50% of one's time at age 3 is different from 50% at age 9. So what I did is I took those percentages and I converted them into an absolute number of hours. I can do that because I have the percentage. I can estimate the number of waking hours per day and per month and multiply that by the months of life. So what I get then is this. So on the x-axis here, you have the thousands of hours spent in French environments over the lifetime. So it goes from 1,000 to 40-some thousand hours, and this is the receptive vocabulary in French. And you can see that the relationship between thousands of hours spent in French and receptive vocabulary, raw score, is quite high. And now what happens with this is that, of course, these are the different groups that I had. And so in blue we have the three-year-olds, red are the five-year-olds, green is the seven-year-olds, and the purple axes are the nine-year-olds. And so you see that there is also, these groups are pretty much stacked up. So if we fit a line for each of the groups, you see that there's also quite an effect of age. And so what happens is that within each of the age groups, there's a significant relationship with amount of exposure. So if you're three, you're going to do better the more exposure you've had to French. But also, the older you are, you're going to do better. So if you look, for example, here at like 10,000 hours here, you see that if you've had 10,000 hours and you're three when that happens, you get a raw score of about 15. But if you're 9 years old when that happens, 10,000 hours, you get a raw score of 80-something, which shows that as you get older, you become a much more efficient learner. And so we have clinically, we're often asked this question, is it better to, like, we know that bilingual kids are going to go to school in French. That's the law. So people often have this question, is it better to expose them to some French in daycare so that they will be ready for school? Or is it better to just wait and have them speak their own language at home and then have them go to school and learn it in school? So the question here is that, you know, if you had to buy the time and pay a dollar for every hour you spend learning French, it does look like you might as well wait. Although we can't know if there are other consequences of doing that, and we have yet to look at their grammatical scores, et cetera, but certainly there is there's a strong age effect, and if we compute the correlation with age, simply between age and vocabulary score, that is a seriously high correlation that we get. So. We also try to look at, these are very preliminary data, but if we compare our sequential and simultaneous learners that we have in grade 1 and grade 3, in this graph we've plotted their receptive scores. The red dots are the sequentials. And so you can see that the sequential learners, they have started much later to learn French, so they have clocked much fewer hours. But at least with a small sample, they do score pretty much within the same range as the simultaneous learners. And there is, we have to confirm this or not with more data, but there are certainly many reports in the literature, or several that I know of, that have documented sort of an initial very rapid phase of learning when kids are first exposed to a second language. So I remember a study by Janet Patterson and her colleagues, a study by Hammer and et al. That have looked at kids who, Spanish-speaking children who go to Head Start programs. So they're kids who are not doing well in language. That's why they go to, or who are from low SES backgrounds. And they're sent to Head Start programs, and they have like a very rapid learning of English within the first year. So whether that initial spurt is maintained over time is not really known. The third graders, we have more variability, but you see kind of the same pattern, that the sequential learners, many of them are scoring quite high and apparently in the same range as the simultaneous learners. So if we compare that with the non-word repetition scores plotted against thousands of hours, you see that in contrast, the non-word repetition scores all bunch up quite high. And there is, if we fit those lines also there is a bit of an age effect also in non-word repetition, so the kids do get a little bit better over time, but the effect is not nearly as strong, and the lowest the kids score is around 80%, which is why we're able to use that as a diagnostic test. So in a study that we did here in Montreal with monolingual French-speaking children, with language impairment and without language impairment, we established that the most accurate cutoff for non-word repetition was 82%. So 82% diagnosed 5-year-old monolingual kids with 90% accuracy. It was pretty much 90% sensitivity and specificity. And that is among the best that you get with diagnostic accuracy for SLI. So you can see that it looks like that kind of criterion might work also for bilingual children, in that extremely few children score any lower than that. If you compare that to the data for vocabulary, if we wanted to use those data to make diagnostic decisions, we'd have to have different decision rules or criteria for each of the age groups. So the lines that are plotted there, the straight lines, are the -1 standard deviation lines for each of the age groups. So what that would mean is that if you are 3 and you score above this line, and you're bilingual, we could declare that you're probably fine. But if you are 5, you have to score above this line here, and so on. So so the data that we've collected here, with this careful documentation of amount of a previous exposure, can help us make much better diagnostic decisions. That is, if you're above this line, you're fine. If you're not, then we have to go to the more detailed data. So this was a graph for the 5-year-old children in different exposure groups. So these are the French-speaking children, French only, more French equal, and more English. So, but then we'd have to, based on a previous exposure of the individual child that we're testing, we could use these different criteria to, as appropriate, to try to come to a decision. So this is the reason why I think we keep saying that we don't have bilingual norms, because bilingual norms does not mean taking some test and giving it to a bunch of bilingual kids. It means giving it to bilingual kids of different types, and it means understanding better what are the background factors that we have to take into account that are strong influencers of the kinds of scores that the kids are going to get. And since I have time, I just want to mention something else. Do you notice here how the English scores, these are raw scores, they're higher than the French scores? So this is the same test. It's the PPVT, the most used time test of all times. It's in every single study ever published on children. And then the EVIP is the French, Canadian-French adaptation of this test. It's the same test. That was normed. We're not using the norms because the norms for it, the published norms, are pan-Canadian, so they include bilingual kids from all over Canada. So we can't use them. Quebec French children do much better. They do about a standard deviation better than that norm. So that's why we always use our own norms for Quebec. But do you see how the raw score on this test is simply higher in English than in French? And we see that not only on this test, but we see it on a bunch of other tests, including the MacArthur CDI. So a parent report, that is the second most used test of all times. We see it in vocabulary from language samples. So basically, English, if you compare kids who are well-matched, English and French, on the type of exposure they've had, they're going to score higher on vocabulary in English, and they're going to score higher in French on all kinds of grammatical measures. And that is just a function of the way that the languages are and what kind of structures they use to convey meaning. So English has a lot less morphology than French and so forth. And so what it means for us when we're testing children for clinical purposes or for research is that children who have equal proficiency in both languages, they're not going to get necessarily the same score in both languages. And it also means that if you do a study and you want to have kids who have equal proficiency in French and English, if you pick kids who have the same score on the PPVT and the AVIP, then you have actually French-dominant kids rather than equal equal proficiency kids. And I think that's the future directions that we're looking at is we're looking at this. We're looking at much more complex measures. We're looking at measures where we have the kids learn in a complex context to see whether we see different effects there. And I'm doing a continuing a study of L2 speakers of Icelandic, and that is it's a very different population, and I think I might mention it because we're in a time period where we're very into bilingual advantage and bilingualism is so wonderful, et cetera. The L2 speakers in Icelandic are a bit of a disaster area. They go to school, they go to preschool, they're not picking up the language. So that's that brings in another variable that might have to do with a motivation to learn, the complexity of the language, the global, the economic value of the language on a global scale, you know, what you feel that it buys you to actually go to the length of learning it. So that's where I'm going with this. So thank you. Are there questions?
Really enjoyed your talk. I was just wondering, you've looked at exposure, frequency, and number of hours. Have you thought about how to look at use of language, children's use of language as well, and do you think you would see the same sorts of patterns? Or?
You know, in this study, what we did is we had a parent questionnaire, and it's quite detailed, but it asks, so you have to try to hit the right level of complexity so the parents can do it. But we asked them for every year of life, you know, who's in the home, how much time was spent at home, what daycares were attended, what dates of attendance, how many hours per week, who else is in the child's life. So for that, we compute that this number, this percentage for each year of life. So for these kids, it changes. It can change quite a bit. And we did look at whether it mattered, the setting, whether both languages are spoken at home, and that didn't matter. But anyways, you know, this is, so we didn't ask, you know, do you often talk, do you, so we didn't do that. But this, so that is a limitation, and you know what, there are some studies that have shown that speaking the language matters also, not only input. So what this is the number of hours of potential communication, the hours that you spend with actual people. So it does not include TV. But so I recognize that is a limitation. But this is similar to what we do in monolingual norming. So when we norm a test for monolinguals, we just say, you know, what is your background, like SES, ethnic background, and then how old are you? And we don't ask how often are you read to? You know, how many times do you talk? So this is, you know, this is kind of an attempt at bilingual norming, and it, in that sense, it is similar to monolingual norms. No. I agree, and there's a study by Bowman and a student of Elizabeth Peña's where they do talk about the you know, talking is important too. So there's a recent study that I know of. So yes, it might be important.
Hi, Lynn. I really enjoyed your talk. Thank you. I just want to ask about sort of two ideas that came up in your talk. So one idea is the idea of you've shown that balanced exposure seems to be really good and it can buy you into the normal range in both languages. I think you mentioned that.
Well, it's good in that that makes you score within normal
yes.
limits, but not as high, not quite as high.
Right.
So it's good if you want to know both languages.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you that your other another important point was sort of what does 1 hour a week by you when
yeah.
you're 3 versus when
yeah.
you're 5. So I sort of found those, you know, to be maybe at odds with each other. I'm not sure. So maybe I could just get your thoughts on that. Are they at odds? Does having balanced exposure earlier perhaps help you to get a better outcome in both languages? And how do
you
sort
know what?
Of think about that?
I don't really know. But what surprises me in these data is that the simultaneous bilinguals, you know, once you see the limited data they had for first and third graders, they don't seem to have any advantage that they maintain. And so the sequential bilinguals, the fact that they are able to get good so fast, you know, they haven't been bilingual forever. They haven't been building up some bilingual advantage. It's just they go to school and boom, they can do it. You know, and so one thing that puzzles me about these data is a lot of times, like if you look at the graph where I showed that it takes about 50% to score pretty much within the normal limit, a lot of the times when we see that, we say, wow, aren't these bilinguals good? Wow, how can they do it? But another way to look at it is to say, why aren't the monolinguals better? They have twice as much time. Why aren't they learning, you know, past 2 in the afternoon, they're not doing anything? And I think I've thought about what that might be, and I think it might be maybe the input that they get is that's what it is. It's redundant and it's repetitive, and maybe the richness of it is just not greater than that.
So back to the threshold.
Or maybe
idea.
Who knows?
Interesting. Thank you.
Just a very quick follow-up on that. So, I mean, with having in mind that everybody's saying that at least at phonological level, the sooner you start the second language, the better, the more native-like and all that. So wouldn't that be a little bit dangerous, saying that you can wait till school time? And
well, I think it's dangerous to say that based on the few kids that I had up here. So no, I'm not saying that very strongly. I find that, you know, certainly the early, everybody agrees that the later you go, the more likely you are to have a foreign accent. But I find that even with the L2 speakers of Icelandic, pretty, you know, they can start pretty late and we don't hear any accent. So I don't know. I think that what I was looking at here, like clinically, we look at, you know, like what do we mean by being native? You know, what we look at is, are you functioning? Do you have enough language that you can get through life, even if you do it in another area of your brain, which is interesting, but, you know, for purposes of functioning in a daily life, of us giving you intervention, maybe we're not going to intervene, right? So that's the level that I'm looking at. Like, do you have the language that you need to understand what's going on in school and to keep learning? And so we see that, I just looked at vocabulary. I have yet to look at all the other areas of language. And so no, it's premature for me to say to everybody, you can wait. But there are indications that may be an okay strategy. And that is all, you know, if you look at the old works of Jim Cummins, the threshold hypothesis, that has been a recommendation that's been out there for a very long time, to have a strong base in your first language, and then you're in place to add another language. That's it. Thank you.